And we're going to continue now with the third panel of this week's conference. It is the last one before lunch. It is moderated by Thomas Heal, who is the chairman of the Luxembourg Fund Labeling Agency, LuxFlag. He will guide you through this panel with his four panelists. Enjoy.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Soren. So the question is, what is the right approach to channel private capital in view of solving social problems? Well, social welfare is not new. Efforts to help the poor and pursue an ethical society date to pre-biblical times. And indeed, these themes are central to the world's main religions. The Judeo-Christian story of the Good Samaritan, zakat, or almsgiving in Islam, or the tenet of compassion in Hinduism or Buddhism are all examples. Up until the age of reason, helping the poor and promoting an ethical existence was the responsibility of the temple, the church, and the mosque. Now that began to change in the 16th and 17th centuries with the emergence of powerful, centralized, and secular states. This is a picture of Bismarck, and Bismarck was well known for introducing old age pensions, medical and unemployment insurance in late 19th century Germany. There's another example, Jules Ferry in France, which introduced public secular schools. And this movement accelerated after World War I, the Great Depression, and World War II. And in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal epitomized this. That was then carried on in the United States by Lyndon Johnson with his Great Society in the 1960s. And that all mirrored parallel efforts in Europe for social welfare and justice, all supported by the public sector. That paradigm became commonly accepted, that the state was responsible for welfare and the role of the private sector was to maximize profits. And that model was supported in the neoclassical approach. Milton Friedman here, shown Nobel Peace Prize winner, who famously said in 1970, the social responsibility of business is to increase profits. And this neoclassical view, which stems from a profound philosophical debate supported by statistical and mathematical models, demonstrates this conclusion. And Adam Smith's invisible hand of laissez-faire capitalism typically offers the most optimal allocation of scarce resources. So by the 1960s, we had reached this happy equilibrium. Social welfare was the state, and private firms and investors should be concerned only by profit maximization. Now that changed beginning in the 1970s. First, environmental and ecological concerns became a key political and business issue. This is shown in Chernobyl in 1986. Before that, we had Three Mile Island in 1979. More recently, Fukushima, 2011. The 1970s also saw the oil crisis, where there became a distrust of big oil. There were also spectacular environmental disasters like Bhopal in India, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, and more recently, the Deepwater Horizon. Climate change concerns also kickstarted a whole industry. And as a result, private companies are being challenged by investors and politicians and NGOs to integrate environmental concerns. Second, efforts by developed countries and multilateral institutions like the UN and the World Bank to eradicate poverty increasingly became questioned. and decades of throwing money at problems have resulted in sparse gains. If you've read Dead Aid by Dambisa Moyo, you'll understand that viewpoint. And by contrast, we then had, in the 1980s, Professor Yunus's efforts in microfinance and social business, which offered an appealing alternative to harnessing private enterprise to cure social ills. And that tendency is also reinforced by the current problems of public finance, because governments have less money to invest and to spend in these social problems. And finally, governance concerns emerged, going back to Enron and WorldCom and Parmalat and other scandals. Also, the backlash against third world labor exploitation led to declarations to improve working conditions in the supply chain. The financial crisis 2008 also created calls for private companies to integrate ethical and governance objectives in their company missions and in remuneration policies. So institutional investors are being forced to scrutinize environmental, social, and governance objectives. So what has been the response? The response has been ESG, environmental, social, and governance trends. So this means that the profit maximization model of the neoclassical world is being called into question, and investors, institutional and private, have jumped on this activist bandwagon, demanding that environmental social governance objectives be integrated, and they're searching for the double bottom line, so financial returns and also social returns. So the question is, well, what's the size of this industry? Now, this is where it gets difficult because it's hard to measure. And one of the main problems in this area is measurement and definitions. But nevertheless, we did some work. ALFI, the Luxembourg Fund Association, and KPMG did some work trying to understand the volume, and it depends on how you measure things. One measure by the Global Sustainable Investment Review put the figure of responsible investing at $13 trillion U.S. dollars in managed assets. We can debate the size, but what is unmistakable is the trend. And in last June, at a very large investment management conference, I was chairing a panel, and I asked the audience, which was about 500 investment managers, this question: should asset managers integrate ESG into their process? And you can see the result. 11% said no, 22% were undecided, but 67% said yes. More specifically, if I look now at only European-based investment funds, so these are UCITS as well as non-UCITS investment funds, this is a much more narrow definition, does not include insurance or managed accounts. We arrived at a number of roughly 240 billion euros invested in responsible investment funds. Interestingly, that amount has grown by about 20% between 2010 and 2012. And if you're interested in this, you can look on the ALFI website, look under responsible investing, and you'll find the study on that website. So we're going to examine these issues now, and we're also going to make this interactive, so I'm going to ask you some questions, and I want the audience to respond, so get your voting machines ready. But the questions are, first, should we encourage private investors to support the green sector? First question. Second question is, can social problems be increasingly solved by the private sector? Should we force investors to integrate governance into decision-making? And I think a pertinent question for this audience, being regulators, what should be your role? So those are the questions, and we're going to now turn to the panel, and I'm going to introduce them, and to give you a little bit of insight as to who we are up against, I asked each panelist to give me a quote, of something that inspired them in their career. And as I give you the quotes, you can think about who is the panelist. So anyway, we'll have a little bit of fun with this. So the first quote, who is it? Genghis Khan was, "Conquering the world on horseback is easy. It's the dismounting and governing that is hard." So who amongst our panelists? Well, it's Michael Chu. Michael, on my far left, is a lecturer at the Harvard Business School, managing director of Ignea Fund, and is a senior advisor to Pegasus Group, a private equity firm in Buenos Aires. Michael has a lot of experience, notably in microfinance. Erik Fried is an Austrian poet, and this is a poem that we translated from German. This probably gives away as to whose quote this was. And the poem, something like this: "Don't hide from obligations in love, but neither from love in obligations." Sven Giegold, on my immediate left, is a member of European Parliament, Green Party coordinator, and also co-founder of Attack Deutschland and the International Tax Justice Network. So happy to have him in Luxembourg. He's also in the middle of an election which takes place on Sunday, so we wish him luck with that. Winston Churchill, "Never give in, never give in, never, 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 in nothing great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense." And I'm happy to introduce Lillian Rocha on the panel to the left of Sven. She is chairperson of the Peruvian Securities Commission, is a consultant with the IMF, and also teaches at different universities in Peru. And finally, Nelson Mandela. This sounds like a quote from the IOSCO mission statement. "I can rest only for a moment, for with freedom comes responsibilities, and I dare not linger, for my long walk is not ended." Of course, David Wright, Secretary General, also visiting fellow at St. Anthony's College in Oxford before that, and before that was Deputy Director General for Securities and Financial Markets. So that's the panel. Those are the questions, and we're going to begin the debate. And if I could ask you to take your machines and answer this question, so we can now put the voting up there. And if I could ask you to please vote now. Should we encourage private investors to support the green sector? So please vote. Well, I'm not surprised by that answer. But I'm going to go now right to Sven. And Sven, tell us a little bit about your reaction to that. Are you surprised? And should we be encouraging private investors to support the green sector?
No, I'm glad. And I'm in particular glad that the response is stronger, yes, than with the investment management industry. So there's still hope that regulation can improve things. So basically, yes, I think it's useful to support actors to put their money into these new sectors. I think if they are profitable, money should flow anyway. But specialized investment vehicles or vehicles which care about environmental criteria help also monitoring and measuring companies, and therefore they have a strong indirect effect through the ratings which have to be done whether environmental criteria are supported. So I think, yes, so this is useful.
Okay, I'm going to now provoke you a bit. Okay. Because in the environmental sector, we've had what I call kind of a boom and a bust, or changes in policies. And most recently, 2 weeks ago, the European Parliament, of which you're a member, voted to reduce the amount of biofuels in use in Europe, I think, to 6%. And that represents, let's just say, a change in policy. There's reasons for that. Biofuel conversions were eliminating forest land, which are carbon sinks, and so it was recognized that maybe this wasn't such a smart policy. But my point, though, is that if we encourage private investors to go into this, and if the policymakers make a mistake, then they might lose money. So what's your reaction to that?
Well, these are markets. In markets, you take risks, including governance risks and changing policies. This is also true for the environmental sector. Second, unfortunately, we didn't vote to change biofuel policies in the EU because by a margin of just two votes, the whole decision was shifted for another 1.5 years. So unsustainable biofuels can go on, and we didn't want to stop biofuel development, but we only wanted to stop harmful side effects such as driving out natural forests or food production. It's horrible.
Okay, so what you're saying is that, all right, we have a policy, but in this case, there was a mistake that was made in the policy.
No, I would say if you do regulation, you make mistakes. Private investors also make mistakes in, for instance, thinking about technology. They invest in technologies such as nuclear energy. This has proven to have so harmful effects that in most countries there's no development anymore of nuclear energy. Lots of private investors lost money, states lost money. If we now transform our economy towards sustainability, there will also be technologies which will be phased out later again. And that's one of the beauties of a market economy, that you do not plan, but that, of course, you try to set certain limits and you set incentives. But which technology and which technologies will finally save the world, we do not know yet. And that's part of the advantages of markets, not to fix and pick only one possible solution. But this means there can be made mistakes and money can be lost.
Yeah. Michael, do you have a view on this topic? First of all, are you surprised by the results of the audience poll?
I'm not surprised, but maybe two comments on this matter. The first is that whenever we talk about social issues and trying to resolve them, I think we engage the heart and the mind. And I wonder, in that response, if it was driven by which? And of course, what one ought to do is combine both. The second is, if we talk about encouragement, encouragement by who and how. So I think, I'm assuming that we're talking about a public sector or encouragement. And I think when you talk about that kind of encouragement, how matters a lot. So if you give incentives to do something, in this case, support the green sector, I think it's extraordinarily important to then figure out a way to do it so that you accelerate development towards the ideal stage you want, but not replace what you want or delay what you want. In the case of just subsidies to engage in a certain activity, for me, is very dangerous, because it rewards activity, it doesn't reward outcome. So if everybody engaged in something, in this case, planting a crop for ethanol, then you're just rewarding the activity, you're rewarding both efficient and inefficient players. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, in the specific case of ethanol, whether the decision was based on a lot of heart, or in calculating actually all the effects of promoting something like that.
David, I want to come to you, and I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot. But if I take the carbon trading system in the European Union, the price of emitting one ton of carbon dropped from 2008 from 30 euros to last week, it was 5. So people who invested in these products obviously lost a lot of money. This was a European Commission-supported market. from your, my question now is not the specifics of that, but from your experience as a regulator and as a policymaker, what do you draw conclusions of that? What would be your view? Should we be going in this direction, or should we be become more prudent in a policy setting?
Well, I would like to say at the beginning that I think a lot of this stems, and I don't want to comment on the European Union's carbon market. I'm not qualified to do so. But I've always felt from the end of the 1980s when I wrote the European Commission's first report on sustainable development at the time of Prime Minister Brundtland in Norway, that it's absolutely essential we measure the economy correctly, both in a macro sense and a micro sense. We do not measure environmental capital correctly. And so the price signals in the economy, I think Professor Chu was saying a little bit of the same, are wrong. I also think that we need to price in and deal with, in a societal sense, the externalities that are caused by environmental damage. We've got to deal with that. And I think if you do that, you start providing the right price signals in the economy for investors to make rational decisions. If you're not prepared to make that intellectual step to measure the costs and benefits correctly, and I'm talking about, I've always favored the idea of having at least a parallel set of green accounts. I know that's controversial, but I think we should try. And I think that if you do that, and you price and tax externalities, you start providing the correct price signals in the economy, which allows investors and companies to grow on a sustainable basis. And I think what Professor Chu said about what do we mean by encouragement. If you do that, that I was talking about, you don't have to pick winners. The market will then allocate capital in a much more efficient way. And so the job of the regulators is to create the right conditions for fair, open, responsible investments, well regulated on a set of principles, ideally at the global level, with the right incentives, as I was talking about. And with another thing, which we always tend to forget, with very tough sanctions for both on the mis-selling side, for the investor side. I think investors actually are not stupid. They'll go where they see good returns. What we have at the moment is a distorted set of economic indicators.
All right. Now, I want to just come back, and Sven, I want to ask you a question. David talked about incentives, and for instance, creating taxes as an example to reflect externalities in prices, which is good economic sense. Now, the question is, where do you draw the line? I mean, this is a political discussion. It's not so much a regulatory discussion. But recently, the HIS Global Insight just published that in the United States, real average household income has been increased by $1,200 per year because of fracking, of searching for natural gas fracking. Now that's a big debate in many European countries. That's been outlawed, and the question is, is it worthwhile going to those to that extent? Because at some point you're going to be reducing household wealth, for another thing, in Germany, there has been an issue about solar panels, and not allowing or creating tariffs on Chinese imports of solar panels. Sven, what's your view on those questions?
Well, to have a discussion as well, I would just like to say that I think we need macro models for regulation and getting finance to go in the green sector, so such as a well-done emission trading system, like environmental taxes, and then the market can play a good role. But it's not enough to set price signals, we also have to set limits. What is the positive externality of a tree? What is the positive externality of a natural reserve? this is not for economics to judge. There we have to set certain limits. And that is not a market-based to be operation whether a natural reserve has to be cut or not. Yeah. So there are things which have to be set as absolute limits, and there are things which can be done by price signals and should be done. In the absence of these price signals, because it's the same lobbies which fight specific regulation which have destroyed the emission trading system on the European level by too many exemptions, bad rules. So we will probably not be able to impose an ideal macro solution. We will have at the same time more targeted approaches, such as the ones where you put your finger into critical points. On the solar panels, I'm not so nervous about these Chinese imports. 80% of the value added is still in Germany. And I think if there are subsidies involved, strong subsidies, there is a legitimation for some tariffs. But if we start between China and Germany calculating our diverse subsidies, I do not know whether such a trade war is really useful. Second, your remark on the question of, give me the keyword again.
Externalities.
Fracking. But that's simply bad economics, because the fracking will prolong the use of fossil fuels, which we will pay later much more expensively, as Nicholas Stern has shown. And I think we are better off investing sooner in the technology of the future, which will be there for the long term, which is renewable energy and efficiency, rather than doing 20 years of a new bubble, and then we will see that the future technology will be in the countries which has made the turnaround first. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to go to Lillian and ask a question about Peru. I've never been to Peru, but I understand mining is a very important part of the economy, and there are environmental problems and concerns. How have you dealt with that problem in Peru, also from a regulatory standpoint?
Well, we are still regulating some areas, but yes, it is true. We have had some communities surrounding mines problems that has to be resolve first, then start the same project. For example, we have a mining project in the north part of Peru, and in order to continue with the project, the company is preparing some water control, quality control water. That means that for us it is very important. You said that Peru is a mining country, and it is true. If you look at our stock exchange, 40% of that is explained by mining enterprises. But our mining enterprises are nowadays working very hard in those things, and for example, Buenaventura, Milpo, and Volcan, there are three cases of three big mining companies that have included in their strategical plans this kind of treatments for the air, for the water, for the waste treatment. Etc.
Okay, but if I understand correctly, the approach is less of a regulatory and political approach or a legal approach as it is a voluntary approach.
No, I would say it's both. It's voluntary from one hand, but on the other hand, it is true that political and regulatory measures are taken from the mining minister, from the economy minister, from the environment minister, but also from the point of view of the superintendency, not only the security superintendency, but also the pension fund superintendency, because they invest in mining mm-hmm. projects too. Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, you were talking, Michael, about this heart versus the mind, and it sounds like, at least in Peru, there's quite a collective approach to the problem, and maybe that's part of the answer. I'm going to go now to the second question. Siobhan, if we can get to the second question, right? Okay, so we're now going to move to environmental to social, and the question is, can social problems like microfinance be increasingly solved by the private sector? So if you could please answer and vote now, yes, no, or don't know. Please vote now. Again, now, okay, I'm a little bit surprised because I would have thought we would have had much more yes. But okay, fine. Michael, give us your view on that.
Well, I think it's very interesting that it is quite close, because actually I agree with both. And of course, my response is yes, but it's a conditional yes. And the condition depends on three things. The first is there should be a gap. Let me explain. If, for example, we talked about tertiary education in Western Europe, I think one could agree that basically access to tertiary education in Western Europe by qualified students is pretty well handled by the public sector and the nonprofit sector. So in that case, the space for a business solution is quite small. But if we talked about primary and secondary education for the socioeconomic pyramid of developing countries, where the state of affairs can satisfy no one, then I think the space for a business solution is very large. The second condition is that a model can be constructed that is profitable, because by definition, there is no space for business if it isn't profitable. The third condition is that that business platform does not cause unintended perverse effects so large that it negates the value that's being created. And by that I mean, for example, monopolies, income distribution disparities that erode the social cohesion of society, and if you can do those three things, if there's a gap, a model can be devised to close that gap profitably, and thirdly, the unintended perverse effects are small. The last 20 years have shown us that business solutions to attend to social issues not only exist, but have tremendous power. And they have tremendous power because they're able to meet better than public sector and better than the nonprofit sector the four attributes that I think are the definition of success for any social intervention, from healthcare to housing to microfinance. And those four attributes are captured in the acronym BEST. B for the best alternative accessible, E for economical, so that it is the lowest cost for the end user, S for solidarity, so that everybody that can benefit from it gets it, and T for today, urgent, because delay for any social intervention that is really important is counted in lost generations.
Okay, I appreciate the model, and I'm going to provoke you a little bit, if you don't mind. Let's talk about microfinance. Mm-hmm. We went from the 1990s, 2000, it became viewed as the solution for poverty, or a very important solution for poverty. And as we all know, the Peace Prize was given to Grameen Bank and Professor Yunus in 2006. And then 3 years later, 4 years later, we had Andhra Pradesh in India. We had problems in Nicaragua. We had complaints about extremely high interest rates. We had complaints about too much money going after into poor areas, and people were taking loans and paying off other loans and buying televisions. Now I'm pushing to an extreme here, but I guess my question is, you're arguing, your second point was it has to be profitable, but does the profit motive, does that not create distortions which can lead to tragedies and serious externalities and problems?
That's a very good question, Tom, because I think profit had nothing to do with the Andhra Pradesh crisis. With that, let me make these quick observations. First, you have to beware of the hype when you talk about social issues. Microfinance is not the solution to poverty. It is just one tool of the great toolkit to address poverty. The second is that the Andhra Pradesh crisis, which for those of you who may not know it, India represented the fastest and largest growing microfinance market in the world. And then in Andhra Pradesh, where 60% of Indian microfinance was concentrated, there were press reports that it led to suicides and there was a clampdown. I think Andhra Pradesh crisis, in my view, had nothing to do actually with microfinance. It had all to do with the threat of commercial microfinance for state politicians that use loans as a way to get political favor. But it also allows me to point out how important regulation is to all this discussion of using private platforms to attend to social issues. Because I think with the best of intentions, the Reserve Bank of India had to act with the Andhra Pradesh crisis. And its reaction was, in my view, with the best of intentions, very negative to the effectiveness of microfinance. So that I think bad reaction for the regulators has delayed the development of financial inclusion in India, I think, for the next decade. Whereas the right regulatory response in what could have been Andhra Pradesh in Bolivia in 1998-99 actually contained it. Mm-hmm. And it allows me to point out that, as Lilian can point out, and as Jaime Gonzalez, who was in the prior panel, can also attest, microfinance has been doing just great in Latin America. It poses a really interesting why there's an Andhra Pradesh crisis in one side and a thriving microfinance industry in Latin America.
Okay. Lilian, could you maybe just tell us a little bit about your own observations about the Peruvian experience in microfinance?
I wish to share with you a very nice data, which is that according to Global Microscope Business, for the fifth year, Peru ranks the first in developing microfinance in a sample of 55 countries. And for us, it's the fifth year. So it is, to us, it's very important. But also, it is important to know some figures. In Peru, 42.1% of the GDP is generated by micro and small enterprises. 59.6% of the economic active population is explained by this micro and small enterprise. That means around 9.12 citizens, workers, and we are 20 million in the whole country. So to us, it's very important to continue developing the micro, the small and also the medium enterprises.
Mm-hmm. And if I understand correctly, our earlier discussion about MiBanco.
About?
MiBanco. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, MiBanco is a bank which Michael knows more than I do because he has been involved in it. But MiBanco and the Cajas, which are little banks, are devoted especially to finance micro and small enterprises, which success. I'm sure that most than I know, Michael can tell us. Mm-hmm.
But now there are other banks that have now entered the same sector.
Of course, yes. They are trying to compete for that segment of the market.
Tom, I think Peru is a very interesting example of the insertion of microfinance into mainstream finance. Today in Peru, 44 of the 55 institutions regulated by the Superintendency of Banks of Peru engage in microfinance. So in the poor neighborhood of Lima, you will see a MiBanco branch, which only 7-8 years ago stood solitary. Now, right next to it, is a Scotiabank branch. And the major banks of Peru are involved in financing what they wouldn't have looked at only 10, 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm. David, I want to come to you in just 1 minute about sort of an IOSCO perspective on this, but if you don't mind, I'm going to now also ask a provocative question. Sven, you have been quite visible in arguing about, as an example, remuneration policies in the financial sector in order to avoid conflicts of interest and undue speculation. So that's one view. Michael, if I understand correctly, you were a early investor in Compartmentos, which is a Mexican microfinance institution that went public in what year?
2007.
And became a little bit of a poster child of the excess of microfinance because the early investors made quite a lot of money. Maybe you did as well, not sure. But so the question is, where do we stand with that? I mean, if you know, do we need the private incentive to channel private capital into these problems to solve these problems? Or Sven, would you argue that was excessive and we can create distortions in the market and conflicts of interest by allowing, let's just say, a free market approach to creating, as an example, Compartmentos?
This was a long chain of arguments, but first, to cheer up a bit, I guess Michael didn't move into that in order to have a quarterly bonus, but you invested in order to fulfill a certain purpose. And if you then have a long-term return, which is good value for money, that's great. But I'm a German, and in Germany, small banks and their federations have 60% of market share in the German banking market, which is the second banking market in Europe. So small banks is not only for developing countries. Microfinance is not only for developing countries. It's very important that also regions which are not the city of London or Berlin or Frankfurt have access to finance and that small entrepreneurs get loans. So I think for regulators, it's key to allow regulation which allows first these institutions to develop. And I think a good financial system should have institutions which have a special business model geared towards these customers, wherever, rich and small countries. And regulation has to be careful not to kill these small institutions by applying rules which are suited for the Deutsche Bank, but not for a rural cooperative bank. So therefore, and I see certain dangers that we have too much one-size-fits-all regulatory approaches, which may well serve the big groups financing the stalls outside, and are less useful for these small institutions, which we should allow and support to build federations supporting each other with specific business models geared towards giving credit to people who do not cannot easily borrow on the market. So that's what I wanted to say.
Okay. I mean, Michael, what would your reaction to that be? I mean, Sven is basically arguing that capitalists or for instance private equity investors should be motivated by the heart and not so much the bank account. What do you think?
To that specific question, let me just add one comment to what Sven was saying, which I agree totally, and that is that regulatory bodies must understand that large banking is different than microfinance, and then not change the criteria of prudential, asset quality, etc., but just regulate it differently. But having said that, I'll come to your question, which is, I think that intentionality, the profit and the heart, doesn't matter. That it's totally irrelevant if you view it from the eyes of the people that we want to benefit. In the case of both in the developed and developing countries, what matters is what happens in the street. So it doesn't matter if somebody comes with intention of doing good, if Mother Teresa, or if you come and you want to be Warren Buffett through what you do. What happens is what happens in the street. Just as when we go into a pharmacy, we just want to buy the aspirin very quickly, we see it, we pay for it, and that aspirin is just as cheap as anywhere else. We don't care if the pharmacy chain is making a lot of money or not. In fact, I flew here on an airplane that's probably losing money tremendously. So I think the criteria should shift from a discussion which happens a lot in the social sector and in responsible investing. What is the level of profit, et cetera? And I thought one day, wait a minute, why are you paying so much attention to shareholders? Pay more attention to the person in the street and how they get the delivery of the service. Because again, what I think matters in the street is getting the best alternative at the cheapest price with massive coverage and as soon as possible.
Okay, Sven.
But only one point of disagreement. I think institutions with a purpose which combined business activity with a social purpose have helped a lot to get ordinary people to get good and available services or products. So therefore, looking again at the German banking system, these small banks, they all have in their mission statements a social purpose. They make profits in order to have these objectives. That they do not follow that always is also true. I would say it matters. So if you have a mixed economy in which you have a part of the private business geared towards social objectives, that makes your whole system more humane and more cohesion in the society as a whole. So to me, it matters whether you have a part of the economic system run by cooperatives, by social businesses, and so on.
Okay. David?
I think it's a very interesting discussion. I think I very much agree with Sven that I think you need financial markets and financial institutions in economies to be very diversified. And I think if you take the case of Germany during this crisis, I think most people, I think, would agree that there were benefits of having small banks who knew their customers, who did not cut their credit lines in tightening economic circumstances. That was not true everywhere. So I think a plurality of institutions increasing the supply side, increasing the offer on the supply side, I think is a very desirable and sensible way to go. I think the question here, and I think it was posed on the previous panel by Rumna and by Ranjit Singh, is how can these institutions and these new techniques really help to reduce poverty, to improve inclusion in society? There are many people in Europe who didn't have access to a bank account until quite recently. And that is the real challenge, it seems to me, that we face. Let's take the European example. You know, I have a great worry that there are many wonderful ideas out there, many young people full of energy who need a start, who need a little bit of capital. I don't think they're getting it. And part of this is the problem that our attitudes to risk-taking are extremely conservative. Our bankruptcy laws are extremely penalizing. I worry about that. So I do think there's quite a lot in the provision and in the necessity of being able to supply small amounts of capital to people and allowing them to improve their livelihoods. And I think this applies in Europe. I think the United States, there's a more entrepreneurial culture, there's a more acceptance of failure, but the ability to start again. In Europe, if you get on the wrong credit list, you're gone. You're gone. How on earth can you earn your living in those circumstances? Well, you have to go and be employed in a company or in the private sector. So we need to encourage this individualism in society. We need to encourage far more the small and medium-sized company development. That's where the growth will be. That's where the jobs are going to come from. And yet there's a serious market failure in many parts of Europe. Let me just talk about Europe because I know it better.
Okay, we're going to move on to our third topic, and we're going to come back to the role of regulation in just a minute. But so we did environmental, social, and now governance is a third area. And there's been a lot of discussion about governance, which relates to proxy voting. It relates to integrating ESG in company objectives. And the question is, should we force investors to integrate governance, good governance, into their decision making? So if you can please vote now, please. Surprise. Okay. So let's just say close to two-thirds being a yes. And Lillian, the question I want to ask you is, and I'm going to give an example. There's been a lot of discussion around governance issues and also concerning the supply chain. So, as a company, am I doing things? And are my suppliers acting in a way which is socially responsible? And of course, we all know the tragedy in Rana Plaza in April of 2013. And you know, in the debris, we found products that were going to go to different companies. I won't mention the companies, but we all know the names. And so the question is: do you think that from a regulatory standpoint? Do you think that we should force companies to move all the way back the chain to ensure good governance, not only on themselves, but also their suppliers?
First of all, I am certainly aware of the importance of the corporate governance practices, either by the enterprises, the companies, but also for the investors that invest their money in those companies. But I think, I disagree, I think that we cannot force investors to integrate governance into decision-making process. I would say that we can have disclosure requirements. We can have commitments coming from the companies in order to be disclosed in front of the investors. But I cannot think that we can force investors to do it. It's on the company's side with the duty is. Investors shall decide to invest by or through the information that the companies give to the market. The important issue is the transparency of the information. The important issue is to have the real access to that information in several ways, web pages, public registries, whatever. But I don't think that we can in any ways force the investors to think what the companies have to think for them. The companies are in the duty of giving them the whole information and the most transparency as they can.
Okay, so your approach would be a transparent approach rather than a regulatory approach to enforce governance.
This is a regulatory approach because regulations impose enterprises, companies that go public, that have public issues, to have the most transparent information in the market to be used by everyone at the same time with the same level of knowledge.
Okay, Sven, do you want to react?
My intention would be that good corporate governance, as you were saying, should be binding for all public companies, and this is not where we have to force investors to integrate that, but as soon as it's possible to invest in a company publicly, good governance has to be there and required by law. And problems we are still having, they have to be addressed.
But David, wasn't there an issue about proxy voting? I remember these discussions where, you know, we said investment managers, as an example, or a fund manager, should engage and should be forced to vote on corporate decisions. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't like the word force. I prefer the word we were talking about earlier, which is strongly encourage. I do think that we have this major problem that the owners, effective owners of companies, are not engaged enough in the companies they invest in. So I think we can do a lot to make that encourage and facilitate it through all electronic means. So I think that's very important. I mean, companies tend to forget who actually owns them. It is actually the investors. But then we have this principal agency problem, which is so difficult to deal with. But I think I'm on the side of the argument of Sven here about corporate governance. I think that this crisis has shown the worst forms of corporate governance, an extremely strong correlation between the worst forms of corporate governance and those firms that failed, almost 100% correlation. The megalomaniacs in charge, the hopeless boards, useless risk management, those were the ones that failed. And as Jacques Larosière says, if you think about a board of 10 people, average age 50, you can either have 500 years of top quality experience on that board or 10 poodles. Mm? And I do think it matters. Mm. It matters a great deal. And it matters a great deal that the CEO is not somebody who can just run a company with an iron rod and to hell with everybody else. Mm. Those are the firms that have smelled danger. So I think corporate governance is underestimated in its importance. I've heard a number of people say that here. For me, I always describe this as the fifth column. You know, we've got to get resolution, derivatives, bank capital, and the shadow banking system sorted out, and this.
Michael.
Yes, I should preface this by saying that I'm on the board of two New York Stock Exchange companies. So you should not take these comments as related to those companies. The comments I'm going to make are systemic. I think that there's a huge crisis of governance in public companies, a huge one. I don't think that it pertains to the regulatory environment. I'm not sure that the regulatory environment can attack the basic problem, the basic cause of the problem as I see it. And the basic cause of the problem is that in public companies, in capital markets, in public companies, ownership of the company is in the hands of one type of fund managers, which if they don't like how a company works, it's very easy to just tap a button on the computer and sell. So their response to a large problem is selling, as opposed to another type of fund manager, which is private equity. Now, I should also disclose that I used to be in the leveraged buyout business with KKR. And I think we participated in the 80s and early 90s in a massive transformation of American industry. Because a private equity fund manager does not have the luxury of bypassing the fundamental problem of a corporation. They must address it because they're long-term owners. Or the ownership is so tied to them. You know, so it's the difference between having owners that own when a large amount would be 1.5% of the shares and somebody who owns 95% of the shares. This is a great problem because as a Harvard Business School colleague who wrote a book on governance in Enron, he said, I'm writing this book on Enron not because it's a five-legged cow, which would make it, you know, such an incredible aberration. I'm writing this book because I think Enron is a four-legged cow on steroids.
On steroids.
Right. And this is a huge problem.
Okay, we're going to go to our last question, which is a relevant question to the regulators in the audience. So, it's almost like a summary question, which is: should regulation be used to channel private capital into environmental, social investments, and also governance objectives? So, if you could please take your voting and vote now, please. All right, David, I'm going to start with you, Director General of IOSCO. We've had this big debate. What's your view? And if I could also ask you, what should be IOSCO's role in this area of responsible investments?
Well, as I said earlier, I would have said no to that question. In the sense that I think, as I explained earlier, I think there's a lot to be done about getting the price signals correct, corporate governance correct. I strongly support integrated reporting. I think there is not enough essential information being given to investors. I think my chairman, Greg Medcraft, would say that, for example, audit quality needs a dramatic improvement throughout the world. But I don't think it's the right thing to do to steer investment in that, in the way this question suggests. But I do think the transparency aspects, the price signal aspects, and all of that, that is important, very important. So I would, that's the way I would come at this. So I'll stop there.
Sven, I want to ask you a question about, in a European context, we've seen now this whole discussion about infrastructure and infrastructure investments. And the question is, you know, should we encourage private capital to invest in long-term infrastructure projects? And, if I'm not mistaken, there is a directive or a regulation that might come from Commissioner Barnier's commission on Director General on long-term investments. On the other hand, I read recently that IFAMA recently said, why should private investors step into the gap if government is not prepared to invest in long-term investment infrastructure projects? Where would you stand on this this question?
Well, first of all, I think there are some long-term investment infrastructure where private capital probably is not so useful. There are others where private capital can play a big role. It has to be differentiated now a lot. I'm not so happy having my local school invested by private capital when it comes to building the energy infrastructure for renewable energies. Private capital can play a huge role. It depends on the sector. And I think there's lots of infrastructure examples where it can well work. But I would like to make a comment on David and also on your vote. The term channel sounds so much like steering. And I think in a market economy, you should be careful steering money. But there's information problems, in particular when it comes to green, sustainable, ethical investment. Everybody calls everything green, sustainable, ethical. And in particular, if retail investors who tend to buy more and more organic food, who want green power, they also want green investments. But if everybody can call everything green investment or ethical or sustainable, this is not, and you have to read through complex company reports in order to make your choice, that's very difficult. So what I think what regulators can do is set some minimum standards and protect the term. In European legislation, the organic agriculture exploded after we defined what organic means. So you don't torture your animals, you don't use poisons. And then as soon as citizens knew what organic really means, they were more ready to buy it. And I think that we can also do with ESG investments, which doesn't mean steering the money. It's saying it's solving the information problems and asymmetry problems of information so that more money goes into these sectors. So I think that regulators can and should do.
Dave, maybe I'd ask you to respond to that because, as I said at the very beginning, definitions are one of the biggest problems in this sector. And there's been a lot of criticism by asset managers saying, you know, there's no definitions. I would say, why don't they come up with definitions? But, I mean, there is criticism. In Luxembourg, as an example, we have created a labeling agency. I've got the privilege to chair that called LuxFlag, and we try to give definitions and we try to define and give a label to microfinance and to environmental investments. It's not easy, but we have a process that works. I guess my question is there not a role for IOSCO to try to build around these ideas that Sven just said and try to give some definition and some standards?
Well, Sven, as usual, puts very interesting points here. I think it would be awfully difficult to do that at the global level. I just think there are such a mix of different philosophies and cultures and you know, ethics, what do we mean by that? It'd be awfully difficult to, perhaps not impossible, I think it'd be awfully difficult. But I think Sven makes a good point that, you know, it's too easy for those who sell funds or whatever to just label them with inaccurate terminology. So I think I would look for if anything for the very broadest of guidance without being too prescriptive. I would get very worried about being over prescriptive. On the long term, if I may, just a few points on the longer term financing issues. This is a major problem, and IOSCO is. As a result of being here, I think we're going to do far more work on this. And this is certainly going to be taken up by a number of our committees, including the growth and emerging markets. We've clearly got market failures here. We've seen this powerful tendency towards short-termism and the growing role of intermediation. The Kay Report and others, Sven and I were on a panel a few months ago on that. So I do think this is a big issue. And I think, I don't know what the answer is, but I think we certainly need a plural supply side, which is equity markets that are liquid, bond markets that are liquid. The bond markets today are not liquid. Even in the United States, they're not liquid. We need sensible securitization. We need a top-class asset management sector. I mean, after all, it seems to me that we are inevitably moving towards the private sector playing a much bigger role in pension provision in the longer term. If you think about Europe, that has to be the case with the pressure on public sector deficits and aging. And that would be good for, that will help, it potentially could help longer term investments. We need the stock markets, the trading platforms to be efficient, proper clearing and settlement, and so forth. So it's actually an accordion of different policies which have to link together to provide the right framework, both for short-term financing and for long-term financing. And that is not the case today. So I think we think, IOSCO thinks this is a major issue. It's a G20 issue as well. Mm-hmm. Been flagged in the recent summit in St. Petersburg. So we're intending to occupy this space.
Lillian, any thoughts on the role of regulation in this whole area of responsible, sustainable finance?
As a regulator, I am convinced that we have to play an active role in this matter. But I think we have to have inputs from the issuers, from the investors, and once again, even when I don't consider that we have to push investors to have an active role in this, I would trust once again in transparency of information. Mm-hmm. That's what I need to know.
Okay, Michael?
I talk as a regulee, not a regulator. Mm-hmm. But precisely as a regulee, I think that it's a matter of priorities. So I agree with Sven, the importance of some definitions and the importance of trying to promote the ESG side. But when you look at capital markets today, I think that the challenges that should be top priority, integrity of information, transparency of information, contain enormous challenges to meet that in a world in which financial creativity is at such a pace that to understand what you're regulating is hugely challenging. So in order to do its basic things right today, I think, for capital market regulators requires enormous attraction of talent, of resources to apply to an ever-changing world. I've been a participant in the derivative market. I've been part of some of the cutting edge of financial innovation. It's like Schumpeter said, when you have finance acting with the real world, it can be a huge tool for development. When you have finance acting on finance, that's when you create disasters. Mm. And the last crisis was exactly that, because we weren't aware of the trillions that were built on one single transaction until it was too late.
Mm-hmm. Sven?
I cannot resist saying that some of the big problems of the financial crisis were also triggered when finance hit the real world. Look at 1 million unused buildings in Spain. That was not only globalized finance on securitized products. I think we should have a more realistic look at market economies. Market economies have always had tendencies to bubbles, and we must make our systems more resilient. And some of the buzzwords in order to get there were mentioned by David. So we need more buffers, we need more systems which do not account only for market prices, but have buffers in companies so that they can be resistant to fluctuations, and we need counter-cyclical elements. So I think in the whole regulatory debate, we have talked too much so far about certain entities, banks, shadow banks, derivatives, so tools. We have too little attention on the whole macro issues. And that's something which is key. I would also agree with David. If I would pick the three most important things in financial regulation, I would not come up with a sustainability label. But this doesn't mean that it shouldn't be done. I think a last point on David. I agree with you. We need more capital-based finance of pensions. But in order to do this, we need a financial system which eats less of the returns of investors. So far, we have a system where the sales process and the administration eats too much of the investors' return. As long as our systems are not changed, how we sell financial products, how effective that is, and how slim the administration of the funds is. But to put it more directly, if you guys do not manage to shrink the financial sector, it's not responsible to let this sector organize our pensions. Okay. So I think this is needed.
David, final word.
Yeah, well, I was going to very much agree with what Michael said. I think that is the great challenge for the regulatory community today, which is to really fully understand the financial system. And today, that is not the case. If you just take shadow banking, for example, we simply do not know enough about the interconnectivity between the various identified strands, and there are probably others. Many corporates are acting as banks today, providing credits to their suppliers because nobody else will. They are banks. And I've heard some of them in my meeting saying, I am a bank. Maybe you didn't know that. And this is very important. As it is, actually, Sharon Bowles has this vision of the regulators having all the information they need on an interactive basis. That's perfectly possible today. We don't have sufficient data. Mm. Very difficult to regulate a market that, in parts of the market that you don't fully understand with insufficient data. I mean, that simply is not good enough. And this has to be a priority for the global regulators and the sectoral regulators to improve. And here comes the resourcing problem, Michael. You know very well the wage levels are hugely different between the type of talented people you're talking about, which is exactly the sort of people you need in the regulatory world, who can earn X times more in the private sector. I don't know what the solution to that is. You hope that as people get older and wiser, and many do, they have a public sector reflex and want to help the broader public good, but it's an unresolved problem, and I suspect it always will be. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to conclude. I didn't give my favorite quote when I was introducing the panelists, and this is my favorite quote, which is from a Greek general in the 5th century BC, Pericles, who said, "The key is not to predict the future, but to be prepared for it when it happens." And if I could just give a small advertisement to the host country here, Luxembourg, in this area of responsible investing, we are quite prepared. There's a lot of debate. I think it's a very interesting topic. This discussion, the panel, I think, raised many, many issues that I think we need to now cogitate and think about. But we do have a label, which is the Lux Flag label. We have a index on the stock exchange, which is a sustainable stock exchange. The fund association has made responsible investing a third pillar in our approach. The government is also very involved. 0.7% of GDP is dedicated to development projects in developing countries. So I think Luxembourg will be ready when the future becomes well known. So thank you for your attention, and please join me in thanking the panelists.